Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. Today, our guest is the one, the only, Deborah Weiss-Ford. She is back for another exciting, that's right, Deb, I'm being very clear, exciting show today. How are you?
Well, I'm good, and thank you, David. I appreciate it. Happy to be back on the Power Hour. Thanks
for
inviting me.
We appreciate it so much. And today, we're going to be talking about investigations in a COVID world. Deb, do you really need to do an investigation in the COVID world? I mean, come on. Can't we just, like, skip it this year?
Well, you know, there's a part of me that wants to answer yes to that because I want to answer yes to everything that's not COVID. So, look, you know, we still have to go ahead and do these investigations. It remains a critical issue in defending lawsuits, and the failure to investigate or perform an inadequate investigation leads to lawsuits. Still a very hot issue for plaintiff's lawyers. So the answer to the question, unfortunately, is yes, still needs to be done.
Well, of course it does. And, you know, today I think, you know, we talked about it. We're going to talk about duty to investigate. We're going to talk about investigations in a remote workplace world. And, of course, you have some rules, you say, in regards to conducting effective investigations. I think that'll be very, very important information for HR and business owners today. So what starts with some of the basics, if we could, before we get into the duties. What has really changed in the investigation world right now? And what do we have to keep at the highlight before we get into all the details?
Right. So, you know, in the COVID world, it is much more difficult to investigate. There are just a lot of challenges. You know, we think of investigations as doing them in person, and that has always been the benchmark for any good, thorough, fair investigation. But in the COVID world, how do you do this investigation when you know that it may be unsafe? You may have people who are uncomfortable meeting personally. You may not be able to meet personally, depending on the jurisdiction and the executive orders. So there are lots of challenges. So, you know, the word is that we don't want you to put off investigations simply because people are working remotely. You know, it shouldn't be out of sight, out of mind. I have a complaint, whether it's harassment or discrimination or bullying or people not playing well in the sandbox. What we don't want you to do is just ignore it. You still have to go ahead and promptly investigate because that is important to the courts and it's important to the EEOC, and it's just a very important issue anytime you're defending a lawsuit. I can't remember the last time I saw a discrimination case or a harassment case where the plaintiff's lawyer didn't argue that the employer ignored the complaint, failed to investigate, or did a crummy investigation. And that's really what we're talking about here.
And that is what we're talking about, the making sure that you do it right. And look, it's hard enough to do these investigations, as you said, normally. So you throw in all the challenges that are out there, it certainly makes it harder. Let's start out with what we would call the duty to investigate. Tell us a little bit about both private and public employers.
Right. So there is a duty to investigate that is set forth by the EEOC, and that's the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the federal agency that deals with discrimination and harassment issues in the workplace. It has clearly come out and said that the employer has a legal duty to investigate complaints of discrimination, harassment, whether it be for national origin or disability or sex or gender, any of the protected classes in state or federal law. So that's said by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. That has also been stated clearly by the courts, both state and federal. Title VII in the CFR requires employers also to take necessary steps to prevent harassment from occurring. So on and on and on, you will see this legal duty by federal courts, by state courts, by administrative agencies that require that you do an investigation. And of course, you know, you anywhere you look these days, you see examples of investigations in current events. You know, you can look back at a source subject for those of us who live in New England, Deflategate. You know, that was an investigation. Penn State University and Jerry Sandusky, that was an investigation. And there are just so many examples. Ellen DeGeneres, Matt Lauer, you know, you could go on and on and on with celebrities that have come under the guise of an investigation, too, because somebody made a complaint in the workplace that there was something improper going on.
Deb, one other question that I'll just throw out there because it does come up. When you have a union shop versus a non-union shop, is there a difference there? Or may it be that some of the collective bargaining agreement talks about investigations?
Yep. So you will often see that in collective bargaining agreements. And that generally means that there is a prescribed way that investigations need to be done. For one thing, there's usually a time limitation. You have to do it in 20 days or 30 days or whatever the time is. And so you'll frequently see that in a CBA. You also are going to have the right to have representation. So there are certain prescribed steps that you will see outlined in most CBAs that deal with this particular issue.
And if the CBA states that you must be in person, and of course you can't be, it's reasonable in this environment to make it so that either by Zoom or other ways is considered still in person. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. And that's a really interesting issue in the COVID world. So most of us are not doing live investigations because of, you know, for all the obvious reasons during the pandemic. Although I did one fairly recently because we thought that it needed to be done live for credibility issues and a couple of other issues. And what was interesting to me is that it really wasn't as effective as it usually is because we were all wearing masks. So you couldn't read the facial expressions and the body language, you know, not as well as you can in normal times. And so, you know, that led me to think that maybe Zoom or WebEx or whatever the platform you're using is likely a better avenue right now than doing it live.
Yeah, body language and obviously facial expressions mean a lot when it comes to investigation, so I certainly understand that. All right. One of the other things you talked about was obviously the EEOC. Have they provided any guidance in regards to investigations?
Yes, there is a guidance that the EEOC put out a while ago. It's nothing that's new, but it basically is an enforcement guidance, and it says that the employer is obligated to investigate. So, you know, you really are required to do this, and for employers that basically don't do anything or don't do a thorough investigation, because there's two issues that really go on here. One is that you don't do it, and obviously that's an issue, and that's going to come back to bite you because you never looked into the employee's complaints, and that's obviously an issue. But equally as difficult are the employers who do an inadequate investigation, and we can get into that when we talk about the 10 tips. But, you know, for me, I generally see that the investigation is done. Sometimes not, but generally it's done. It's just that sometimes it's not done well. Assumptions are made, conclusions are reached before there is a thorough analysis. The person who's doing the investigation is really not competent to do it. I see more of those issues than the head in the sand, I'm not going to do it.
And certainly federal and state guidelines also have some weight here, correct?
They do. In almost all states, there are cases or the administrative agency has talked about investigations. And, you know, when you're defending these cases and discrimination and retaliation cases, harassment cases, one of the first things that the administrative agency asks you to do is to produce the investigation. They want to see what you did. Did you do a proper job? Did you not do anything? Because that matters to the determination of whether there's going to be a probable cause or not.
No, there's no question about it. What did the courts say?
So the courts say the same thing. Federal courts, state courts, they all have come down and said Title VII, which, you know, deals with sex discrimination, among other things, that you have to do an investigation. The state courts say the same. New Hampshire, for example, has a case that's old by now, 2003. They had a case which was a verdict for the plaintiff, and one of the critical issues there was that the employer did not fully investigate. And that's what the jury really focused on in coming to a verdict that was over $1 million.
Wow, that's serious money, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
So, obviously, we have a contractual duty to investigate. Tell us a little bit about what that all involves.
So, there are contractual duties that may be in the CBAs that we talked about, the collective bargaining agreements. You may see it in an employment contract. It could be in your handbook policy. It could be in other policies that you disseminate to employees. So you may give a contractual duty to investigate through these avenues. But even if you don't, even if you're talking about at-will employees, there still is this duty to investigate by federal law, by state law, that has to be followed. So you need to do it anyway.
We're talking with Deborah Weiss-Ford. She's the managing partner at Jackson Lewis Law Firm. And we're talking about investigations in a COVID world. I'm your host, David Chulo. You're listening to HR Power Hour, Educational HR Radio. Deb, you know, we got to do these investigations. They're voluntary in terms of, I read the title on here. It's not really voluntary. It's required. What are some of the best practices?
Well, let's go back and talk about the COVID world a little bit, I think, and talk about how you want to do that investigation, because I think the game has really changed this year and will keep changing as we continue through the pandemic, which doesn't look like it's going to end anytime soon. So for that, I think the employer really needs to look at how you're going to actually do the investigation. And that's a new point that we have to look at, because before it was easier in the sense that we knew we had to do an investigation. Whom are we going to pick to do the investigation? How are we going to do it? But in the COVID world, we have a different issue. Now we have to think about the platform we're going to use. So if you're going to use a virtual investigation, which is mostly what we are doing right now, I mean, I would say almost 100% of the time we're doing remote investigations. And that creates a lot of challenges. First of all, you will have witnesses that are technologically challenged, meaning that they are uncomfortable with the remote access and comfortable with using Zoom or using some kind of a platform. And you've probably seen this in
No question.
Yeah, it's a formidable issue. People just aren't used to it, and there is a learning curve, and that becomes frustrating and a real impediment at times in doing these investigations well.
Well, you know, Deb, it's also the opposite. Really well tech-savvy people can figure out ways to make it, to record, to do other things that you know, can set up their phone to record what you're doing on top of what you're doing. There's other factors that have other people on the other side of the camera that you can't see that can coach and help them. There's other challenges.
Yeah, it is a real issue. I mean, I've been doing a fair amount of them since COVID hit in March, and there are challenges all the time. So you do have that issue. You know, you're not really sure who else is in the room. You're not really sure what documents they're looking at, and that matters. You know, and it also matters for consistency. So you know, you want to do these the same way that you do for each witness. And it's not, I'm finding at least, it's not uncommon for me to do an investigation and maybe I'm interviewing 14 people and 70% of them know how to use WebEx or Zoom or whatever platform we're using, but the other 30 to 40% don't. And they want to do it by phone. And so, you know, you have to do that because you need to talk to the person. And if they're just not going to use the WebEx or Zoom platform, then you still need to talk to them and do it. But it is challenging because, you know, you have this disparity in how you're doing these investigations.
You know, Deb, let me throw out a question for you. Someone's technologically challenged. They don't want to be on the camera. Can you enforce it?
You really can't. At least that's my opinion. I would say no. You know, you make people too uncomfortable. They just don't want to do it. For the most part, people are voluntarily cooperating in an investigation, and so I have decided, through a lot of thought and a lot of trial and error, that I will allow people who just are totally uncomfortable and don't want to be on camera to do it by phone. And so I've worked out a method that has worked fairly well. I would much rather see them, but if they're just going to refuse to do that, I still want to do my investigation. I still want to talk to people, and so I make the phone the next best thing.
Well, you know, you got to do what you got to do, right? It does make it an interesting challenge, especially when you're using tone and inflection to try to gauge results. So I certainly understand that. What else is something that employers or HR professionals should really think about?
Well, you know, it, just sticking still with the remote, you really have to think about the documents. You know, because for me, when I'm doing an investigation, sometimes I'm sharing documents with the witness. And that's easy when you're in person. You know, you bring out the document, you show them. But here, in a remote investigation, you have to figure out a way to screen share because you generally don't want to give the witness a copy of the documents before because you're trying to get their reaction. You know, you're trying to, in real time, get the reaction to a question or a statement or a comment or something like that. So you really have to figure out a way to do that. For me, I often will schedule pre-interview calls just to make sure that people are comfortable with the platform, know how to read a document when I'm doing a document share, and answering any type of questions that they may have about the process of it. So I think it's just a different a way of doing an investigation because of the pandemic. And as I said, you know, this is going to go on for a while. So, you know, you still have another, 3 to 6 months, at least it seems to me, before it's going to go back to what it was.
And even then, the world has now changed in terms of how people are going to view these things. And I think that we have to be cognizant of the fact it could be longer than that. You're listening.
Well, you know, Dave, you raise a good point with that, because it could be that you may have some folks who like the remote access better and maybe prefer, even when this does go away, to do these things remotely. And so, you know, this may be a more permanent change than what we are anticipating right now.
You're listening to Deborah Weiss Ford on the HR Power Hour, and we'll be right back. In today's highly regulated climate, customized HR solutions are needed more than ever. Career Management Associates can partner with your existing HR department for projects or even serve as your outsourced HR team. From compliance and compensation to investigations and employer relations, CMA provides you trusted HR solutions. Call 207-780-1125 or visit cmacareer.com.
Are you looking to hire? Stop wasting time. Jobs in ME.com has been matching Maine employers to job seekers since 1999. Job postings start at only $159 with their Quick Post product. Your employment ad can be distributed to over 75 job boards for maximum exposure. When it comes to recruiting locally, you can count on Jobs in ME to connect you with qualified candidates in this area. Visit jobsinme.com. That's jobsinme.com today. Stop searching and start hiring locally.
At over 150 years old, Verrill has an illustrious history with more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill as one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact Verrill at verrill-law.com. That's verrill-law.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour, presented by cmacareer.com and verrill-law.com. I'm your host, David Chulo. You're listening to the HR Power Hour, educational HR radio. Deborah Weiss Ford is our guest today. We're talking about investigations in the COVID world. We kind of talked a little bit about some of the prep, some of the preparation, or as Deb, we might call it, the preparation I, not H, in terms of investigation, right? And we're, because it can feel like a lot of pain when you're going through this, can't it?
It can. It can. It's very difficult to do investigations. I mean, first of all, it's upsetting in the workplace. Employees tend to find out about it. It tends to be a big deal. You are talking about people's careers sometimes. And it's a difficult process, and I think it creates a fair amount of tension in the workplace.
There's no question about that. All right, so let's talk a little bit about, you know, we've kind of gone through the COVID situation. Is there anything else from a COVID perspective that we should be aware of before we get into the reasons and so forth?
I think that pretty much covers it. As I say, just another layer of issues to think about. But, you know, what else is new? That's how COVID has been for us in so many aspects of employment law.
I'll ask one more question, and I kind of mentioned it last session, but we didn't really talk as much about it. Is, you know, the temptation might be to record it because you have the capability, not that you normally would. What's your advice in that area from an employer perspective?
Yep. So I always tell, first of all, when I'm doing the investigation, I never record it. I just feel that it stilts the conversation, and I think that you don't get the same kind of response when someone knows that they're being recorded. For the witnesses in the COVID era, I ask them not to record it. I don't know if they are or they aren't. You know, I can't tell that, but you know, it is unlawful in some states to record conversations without consent. So you have to think about that as well. But I always make it a practice to tell witnesses that I do not want them recording it. As far as I know, no one has done that. But on the other hand, you know, how would I really know?
No, I understand completely. You know, I want to back up a little bit to talk about complaints themselves. You know, we all know some of the sources of complaints, for example, internal or, you know, for investigation of things. Can you go through some of the ones we might not think about that still have to be investigated?
Yeah, that's a good question, because, you know, we tend to think of these, particularly in the Me Too era, as all being about sex discrimination and sex harassment. And it can be a variety of things. It could be a wage and hour issue. Somebody claims that they're not paid properly, or they're working off the clock, or they're, given improper meal breaks. So it can be something along those lines. There's always a fair amount of equal pay issues, women or men complaining that they're not being treated fairly and equally. You could have FMLA or ADA issues, leave of absence issues, pregnancy issues, falsification of time records, theft, alcohol or drug use is a big one. Whistleblower complaints, someone complaining that the employer is doing something unlawful. So it's a whole variety of issues, and I always try to tell employers that there are just certain buzzwords that they should be listening for. And when those buzzwords come up, they need to do an investigation. Hostile work environment, harassment, discrimination, unsafe environment. I've been intimidated. I've been there's been fraud. I've been bullied. Unlawful activity, violence in the workplace, safety issues. Even sometimes I'm really uncomfortable. I think you just still have to ask that question of why somebody's uncomfortable. Is it sex harassment, or is it religious discrimination? All those type of things. I feel intimidated. So there are just certain buzzwords that employers should be aware of that at least should trigger in your mind that you may need to do an investigation.
I know that employers must show and exercise reasonable care to prevent and correct discriminatory harassment. This word honest belief, and could you explain that a little bit better?
Yep. So there is a growing trend in employment defense cases to use what's called the honest belief. And basically, if an employer can show that it reasonably relied upon certain facts that were before it when it made the decision, the employer may avoid liability. So the employer is honestly relying on certain facts that were credible at the time. And even if they prove later not to be, that honest belief may get the employer out of liability. And we are seeing this in cases across the country, including one in New Hampshire in the federal court that came out last year, where the court is accepting that as a defense. And so for an investigation, to turn that into the investigation, the point is that it does not need to be perfect. But if the employer takes reasonably informed decisions before they take adverse employment actions, that likely is going to be defensible.
You know, this is the big question that always gets popped up, Deb, and I'm sure you know it, and I'll say it. Heck, we're all mostly all at-will employees. Why does this have to be done? Why can't we just make it go away?
Yep, so we get this question, of course, all the time. And because, you know, the at-will is not as meaningful as I think employers think that it is. I mean, of course, it doesn't mean that you can just terminate anytime you feel like it. You still can't discriminate. You still can't harass. You know, you still can't do unlawful terminations, whether it's a statutory issue or something by case law. So there is at-will, which is great. But that exception that rule is limited by lots and lots of exceptions. So that's why you have to look at whether it's a statutory protection or a collective bargaining agreement or constitutional protection like First Amendment, that type of thing. You always have to look at that. So it employers who tell me, and believe me, I get this at least a couple of times a week, they're at will, I can do whatever I want. Yeah, I think employers don't really understand what that means, and that's something that you really need to be up to date on.
If, of course, you're in the public sector, that's a little bit different, isn't it?
It's a little bit different, right? Public sector has some more protections than the private sector does, and they have some less in some cases. They have some better protections in terms of, you know, First Amendment if you're the employee. They both have certain protections, but it's a different analysis when you look at public sector versus private sector.
We're talking with Deborah Weiss-Ford. We're talking about investigations in the COVID world. This is the HR Power Hour. I'm David Chulo. I'm your host today. And we're going to keep talking about investigations in this remote world, especially now the COVID world. So talk to us about the first rule, as we would call it, for conducting an effective workplace investigation.
Okay, so this is my big picture rule. And so what I want the employer to do first is to look at the strategy and look at the plan behind doing an investigation. What is the objective? What's the scope of the investigation? And to me, the critical issue here is, what are you trying to accomplish? And so in this first phase, what I'm doing is looking at the core issues, who needs to be involved, who are the key witnesses. I'm trying to set a timetable, but I know that the timetable is probably going to move because investigations are always fluid. But the first thing that I do is to take a look to see if there are any policies that say that an investigation has to be completed in X number of days. For example, if you're in the public sector, it is very, very common for there to be a policy or a CBA that's going to say that the investigation needs to be completed in 20 days or 30 days or 40 days, whatever, it doesn't matter. But you need to look at that. It doesn't mean that you can't extend that as long as it's done in good faith, but the first thing you have to do is just be aware, what's the policy? Similarly, is there a policy for how the investigation needs to be conducted, which would be unusual, but every once in a while I'll see something weird like that. So in this stage, you're looking at what is the reasonable good faith investigation. So I'm looking at timetable, I'm looking at the objectives, I'm looking at the issues, I'm looking at what I'm trying to accomplish, and then I'm looking at the order, what's the order in which I'm going to interview witnesses. And for me, generally, I start with the complainant, and then I go to various witnesses, and then I go to the so-called accused. And then I might go back and talk again to the complainant because I talked to the complainant in the beginning and something may come up that I didn't know. And so I may go back for clarifying questions.
You know, Deb, it's interesting. You talk about making sure that you follow these rules or timelines or whatever you have within your policies. As you know, I'm on the Maine State Civil Service Board, and we look a lot at the timelines as a key element. Did they follow it to a T? Were they able to do, the investigation within the rules and the timeline? It does make a huge difference in terms of their ability to, present that information to the board.
It does. I had one recently where, I was told originally I would only need to talk to 5 witnesses, but all the witnesses gave me other names, and it ended up being 14 witnesses, and the time period was by a CBA to complete it within 10 days. Okay, that's not going to happen, and it's even more challenging in the COVID era because it is just tougher with using Zoom and other platforms to get people to commit and to get them comfortable to using that type of a platform. So in that case, we were upfront and we said, look, we can't do this in 10 days. We can do this, we believe, in 20 to 25 days. Would that be acceptable? Which, of course, it was. So you can work out these issues. I just think you need to identify them and make sure you know what they are.
Deb, what's the second rule for conducting effective workplace investigations?
So for me, this is the document stage. I always like to review documents before I get into the interviews. There could be a written complaint. There frequently is a written complaint. It may not be something formal. It could just be emails or other documents that the complainant sends that they want the employer to read. There are always going to be policies, whether that is your discrimination policy or your harassment policy. Some employers have bullying policies or anything that's going to be applicable to the investigation that you're doing. So I'm always reviewing that, and I'm looking at the CBAs to, you know, make sure that I'm following the CBA. I also like to see the personnel files of the people that are involved, the key players. You know, I want to read that to see if there are prior relevant complaints, investigation files, all that type of thing, you know, I find to be very important to read just so I can start to get an understanding of what's going on or what is not going on, as the case may be.
So, Deb, when you're getting the documents out, and now, of course, today, most of these things are electronic, and you mentioned before not necessarily sharing this with everybody in terms of it, I just want to talk about the privacy part for a moment, because that access to these documents, a lot of organizations put them in what we'd call a Dropbox or other place that they can hold these documents, and maybe others get may or may not have access to that. How important is it to keep that information so locked down?
Yeah, I think it's very important to do that. I think you need to respect the employee's privacy. It should be on a need-to-know basis. I mean, one of the first things you should be doing here in your e-discovery is preserving documents. So you want to make sure you do litigation holds, for example, so that you can lock in and make sure that emails and other documents are not destroyed by even an automatic system of deletion that every employer has. So it's important that you lock that in. But the privacy issue and making sure that things are not disseminated to people who don't have a need to know is pretty important. And I do spend a lot of time with clients on that issue to make sure that you're protecting those rights.
You know, it's interesting you bring up the automatic delete feature that most organizations have, and that is, of course, for space and all the other reasons that you do it. And, you know, I know a lot of organizations debate on how long they should make that for, and while I'm not asking for a card block answer because I know it depends, gosh, I'm sounding like an attorney now, the reality is what's a good rule of thumb?
So it depends. It does. I mean, it really does. So you know, you've got to keep it for the course of the litigation. And it's not just when the complaint gets filed. If you know about this prior, you get a demand letter or you have reason to know that likely it's going to end up in litigation, you need to start the hold. And look, litigation is slow, especially right now. Courts have been closed, very, very backed up. Very few jury trials going forward, and so you're going to need to keep these things locked up for a longer period of time, because I think for most jurisdictions it's 18 months, if you're lucky, to 2 years to get the trial, and now it's going to be, you know, 3 years probably, you know, until we get through the COVID era. So, you know, you're going to have to lock these things down for quite a while now.
We're talking with Deborah Weiss-Ford. You're listening to the HR Power Hour, and we're talking about investigations in the COVID world, and we'll be right back. In today's highly regulated climate, customized HR solutions are needed more than ever. Career Management Associates can partner with your existing HR department for projects or even serve as your outsourced HR team. From compliance and compensation to investigations and employer relations, CMA provides you trusted HR solutions. Call 207-780-1125 or visit cmacareer.com.
Are you looking to hire? Stop wasting time. Jobs and ME.com has been matching Maine employers to job seekers since 1999. Job postings start at only $159 with their Quick Post product. Your employment ad can be distributed to over 75 job boards for maximum exposure. When it comes to recruiting locally, you can count on Jobs and ME to connect you with qualified candidates in this area. Visit jobsandme.com. That's jobsandme.com today. Stop searching and start hiring locally.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis, as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk, WLOB, 100.5 FM. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour, educational HR radio. Today, our show is with Deborah Weiss Ford. She is the managing partner at Jackson Lewis Law Firm, and we are talking about investigations in the COVID world. We're right now going through, Deb, the 10 top rules for conducting effective workplace investigations. We've talked about number one and number two. Of course, what is the third?
So the third issue is interesting, and it has changed recently, and that is confidentiality. So until several years ago, we always told witnesses, don't talk about the investigation. For the integrity of the investigation, we're going to ask you some questions, but you can't go out there and talk to other employees about it. And there were a lot of good reasons for that. The other people could be witnesses. You know, we don't want people gossiping about the investigation. And several years ago, there was a case in Arizona called Banner Health. And in that case, the National Labor Relations Board basically said that that was unlawful because it violated the National Labor Relations Act. And the specific issue was that that employees under the National Labor Relations Act, whether you're unionized or not, employees have the right to talk about the terms and conditions of employment. So when HR said, don't talk about the investigation, or maybe even suggested not to talk about it, that was deemed to be unlawful, which was a big, big change in this confidentiality issue. Now, that changed at the end of last year. So December of 2019, a recent case came out, and now the NLRB is 3 Republicans to 2 Democrats, which makes a difference. And so in that case, what the board said is that the witnesses can be required to maintain confidentiality during the duration of the investigation. Not forever, but during the investigation, you can tell employees don't talk about it. So for employers who haven't looked at this case, it does change the rules and what you can say to employees about confidentiality.
You know, one of the things that we talk about confidentiality a lot is talking amongst internal employees. So a manager talks to a supervisor, supervisor talks to a leader. What would you advise in that situation, keeping that internal confidentiality?
I would say the same thing. I would say during the course of the investigation, it's okay to talk about things on a need-to-know basis. But if it's not a need-to-know basis and just gossip, don't do it. So there will be managers, supervisors who do need to know certain things about an investigation. And if that's the case, fine. But if they don't need to know, it's really not a good idea to have discussions about it.
Do employers have the same risk about telling them they can't, or is that different?
It's different because they're managerial employees, so they're not going to fall under the NLRA for this purpose. So it's different in that sense. But I always get uncomfortable when managers are talking about an investigation and what somebody might say. It's just, you know, obviously just a really bad idea. And gossip in the workplace is always a problem, always leads to something that's not good.
So let's talk about number four.
So number four is the assessing the need for workforce protection. And that means this, that you really have to think about what you're going to do with the so-called accused. Are you going to put that person out on a paid leave of absence? And that is a common way to go, particularly if you have concerns that the accused is not going to be able to continue working with the complainant or other employees who know about it. It may be an unsafe situation. It may be harassment. It may just be discrimination. And it may be a good idea to put somebody out on leave. I mean, I couldn't give you exact percentages, and it's anecdotal, but I would say probably 80% of the time, at least, the so-called accused is put out on a leave of absence while the investigation is being done. It's generally a good thing to do. On the other hand, what we don't want you to do is to transfer the person who was complaining to a different position, or to put that person out on a leave of absence, because that could be seen as retaliation. So you really need to be careful about that.
Let's talk about identify investigative team, the people that are actually going to work for it. That, of course, is number 5 of the rules of conducting an effective investigation.
Yeah, so this is pretty critical. I mean, who is the person who's going to do the investigation? It could be somebody in HR, But you want the person in HR to be trained for a variety of reasons. One, to get it right, which is the most obvious, but also that person may actually be a witness in defending a case. And is that person going to be a good witness? Are they comfortable? Are they familiar with how to testify? Do they have experience? Do they have the education to do it? Have they been certified as an investigator, taken courses, et cetera? So you really need to think pretty carefully about the person or people who are going to be on the investigation team. And some of it depends on the nature of the complaint. So, for example, last year I was dealing with a theft issue, and we hired a former lieutenant from a police department who was retired because we felt that person would be able to understand the issues and deal with it better. So this to me is really a critical issue. You know, 2 years ago I had a case at the EEOC, and it was an HR person who did the investigation. Very competent, certainly could do the investigation, but the investigation was about a complaint that the president of the company had made to another employee, and the HR person reported to the president. So that's a problem. You know, you don't want to see that, and that was something that the EEOC picked up on right away and became an issue for us.
We're now going to talk about number six for the rules for conducting an effective workplace investigation. What is it, Deb?
So six are the actual interviews, and for me, I am always preparing outlines of questions that I want to ask. I'm going to definitely ask other questions beside that, but I want to make sure that I make a rough outline or a checklist at least of the points I want to cover. I also like to interview people one-on-one. I don't like to do it in groups. I don't think that's a good idea. But if people if someone's in a union, they may want a union rep there, and that's fine. Sometimes someone will say, I want my attorney there. And, you know, for me, I'm pretty easygoing about that, and that's okay with me, so long as I'm able to do the interview and the attorney or the union rep is not interfering. If they want to ask clarifying questions, I'm happy to do that.
When you're talking about interviews and there are other people in the room, are there any rules that you should establish up front?
Yeah, I'm always establishing rules. I'm always saying that, look, you know, I do want to get the full picture, but I want the person I'm interviewing to do the talking. And I don't want the representative or attorney to interrupt unless it's absolutely necessary. I'm okay with clarifying, but I really want the discussion to come from the person I'm interviewing. Now, at the end, I have a practice of always saying to the representative or to the attorney, is there anything else you want me to know? Because, you know, if there is something that the client missed, then I want to know what that is. And it could be that somebody is nervous, doesn't tell me exactly what they should be telling me or want to tell me. The attorney may know that, and fine, you know, all I'm trying to do is get the facts. You know, that's what my job is. I'm just a fact finder, an independent person. And so I don't want someone not to tell me something because they're too anxious about it. I'd rather hear it from the representative.
And that's one of the risks of doing it internally, isn't it? Because you know somebody, you may make assumptions.
Well, that's right. That's right. And, you know, look, we all do that. I mean, that's just what we all do. So I want to just make sure that I'm getting the complete and accurate picture, and I want it to be fair. You know, above all, I want to make sure that people walk out of the interview feeling that they told me everything that they wanted to tell me. If that's not the case, then I didn't do a good job.
We're talking with Deborah Weiss Ford. We're talking about investigations in a COVID world. We're talking about 10 rules for conducting effective workplace investigations. We're on number seven, Deb. Maintain objectivity.
Yeah, so this is really important to do. I mean, it's not always easy to be objective, but, you know, we want to make sure that we are looking at this and giving people a full, fair opportunity to tell us whatever they want to tell us. So, you know, you don't want to have a preordained conclusion. You want to be objective and you want to be open-minded. So you want to make sure that you are doing that. For me, I am always making sure that I'm being objective. I think it's important that the investigator not have a dog in the hunt. So, you know, for example, if I'm representing company X, Y, and Z, I don't do the investigation because I represent that company. I'm giving them advice. You know, the investigations that I'm doing are ones where I don't do any work. for that particular company. And so I don't have a dog in the hunt. My job is just to get it right.
How important is number eight in regards to creating a proper record?
Yeah, so pretty important. So, you know, everybody has a different way of doing this. And so, you know, for me, as I said earlier, I don't record interviews. I just feel strongly that it stilts the conversation. And so I just don't like doing that. On the other hand, I need to take notes because I'm not going to remember what everyone had to say. You know, interviews can last for a while. You know, some of them can be, you know, an hour or more, sometimes several hours if it's a complaint. They have a lot to say, and that's fine. The same with the person being accused. So I'm taking notes. So that you have to get used to the rhythm of that. I know some investigators that will type as they are listening. I don't like to do that. One, I'm a crappy typist, so it's not something I would do. I also don't like that physical barrier of my computer or my iPad being in front of the witness. You know, I just personally find that that interferes with the flow of the conversation. But one thing to really, to whether you type it or whether you write it out, those notes are discoverable. So if you get into litigation and someone wants to see your notes, the other side wants your notes, the court is going to make you cough that up. So you have to be careful to take accurate notes. And so we don't want to see things on the margin characterizing how somebody comes across. She's a jerk. She's a horrible witness. He's an idiot. You know, that type of thing. Because that all is going to come out in litigation, and none of that would be good.
Even if it's true. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM, and we will be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at JacksonLewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
At highway speeds, the average text takes your eyes off the road for about 5 seconds. That's enough time to travel the length of a football field. Stop texts, stoprex.org. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Are you looking to hire? Stop wasting time. Jobs in ME.com has been matching Maine employers to job seekers since 1999. Job postings start at only $159 with their Quick Post product. Your employment ad can be distributed to over 75 job boards for maximum exposure. When it comes to recruiting locally, you can count on Jobs and ME to connect you with qualified candidates in this area. Visit jobsandme.com. That's jobsandme.com today. Stop searching and start hiring locally.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. Today, our guest is Deborah Weiss-Ford, and she has done an excellent job of talking about investigations in the COVID world. We're right now talking about the 10 rules for conducting effective workplace investigations. Again, this is the HR Power Hour. I'm your host, David Chulo, and this is Educational HR Radio. Deb, we just have a few minutes left of the show today. We have number 9 and number 10. What are they?
All right. So number 9 is complete the investigation. I like to see the employer do an investigative report. And that report is going to include the background, how I got the case, what I reviewed, whom I talked to, what's the standard I applied, preponderance of the evidence, that I told the witnesses there would be no retaliation, give a summary of what the witnesses had to say, give the conclusion, and if the employer wants it, recommendations. So, you know, what's important about this is that it be clear and concise, deal with the issues, address the questions you were asked to respond to, and be specific in your findings. Some employers want recommendations. Most, I find, deal with their own lawyers, the lawyer for the company, to make the recommendations. That's my preferred way to go. But the point is that you want to do a report because you want the institutional memory to make sure that you have some kind of documentation about what you did.
Number 10.
Number 10 is the retaliation piece of it. So it's important that you ensure against retaliation. I, at the beginning of the interview and at the end of the interview, always say you can't be retaliated against under state or federal law. I explain what that means. I tell them and give them my card that they should call me if there are any issues at all. And I advise the employer to make sure that managers, supervisors, workers, whomever is involved in this, make sure that they don't retaliate, because any adverse action that is taken is going to look as though it's because of the investigation. So if there is some kind of an adverse action, like a demotion or a termination, if the employer is going to do that in close proximity to when the investigation was done, they better be documented. Good documentation, good disciplinary documentation, whether it's the performance management review or the counseling documents, whatever it is, just make sure that you think that through and get legal advice before you pull the trigger.
As we wrap up the show today, Deb, what is the one thing, if somebody listened to this show today, the one thing that they need to remember, the most important thing in this COVID world doing investigations?
Be fair. I think you really need to go into these investigations not having some preordained conclusion. And you want to be fair and be reasonable, give both sides the opportunity to tell you the various points of view, and then reach the conclusion that seems most credible based on the witness testimony and the review of the documents.
Sound advice, once again, from Deborah Weiss-Ford from Jackson Lewis. As always, Deb, it's a pleasure having you on the show, and hope you'll be back in 2021.
I would love it. I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM. And now, your HR Tip of the Week. Your HR Tip of the Week is being sponsored by Verrill.
Hi, this is Liz Johnston at Verrill. Although OSHA compliance should be on your mind all year long, the winter season brings with it a host of issues that you should keep at the top of your list on your workplace safety plan. For example, if your workplace installs special lighting or arrangements during the holiday or winter months, make sure those arrangements comply with applicable OSHA guidelines and safety requirements. For our friends in the Northeast and other snow-prone areas, be sure that you have protocols and systems in place to maintain safe conditions in any outdoor areas of your workplace, including walkways to parking lots for employees and work vehicles. To comply with your duty to maintain a safe working environment, both avoiding a citation and keeping your employees safe. If you do end up in a situation where an employee is injured in the workplace, make sure your management team understands their obligations to notify OSHA if it's a serious injury. And as with all employee injuries, make sure your team is prepared to take the appropriate steps to report an injury pursuant to your state's workers' compensation laws. If you have questions about OSHA or workers' compensation compliance, contact me or another member of Verrill's employment and labor team.
And that's your HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by Verrill. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM or 1310 a.m. and streaming live at WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.